You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Bill Radke. Well, we're still waiting for the Federal Appeals Court to rule on the case of Washington State versus Donald J. Trump. Meanwhile, we're going to talk now about Nordstrom versus Donald and Ivanka Trump. It's not a lawsuit. It's a retail move and a controversy, though. You see, the president's daughter sells a line of clothes in her name, and Nordstrom has carried it for about 6 years. But now Nordstrom says it will stop carrying the Ivanka Trump brand, not for political reasons, says Nordstrom, but because it wasn't selling well enough, which has resulted in a controversial tweet from the president and a controversial plug from a presidential advisor. And here to sort this out with us is New York Times business reporter Rachel Abrams. She's writing about all of this. Rachel, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what kind of clothes does Ivanka Trump sell? What's her look?
Well, she really appeals to sort of this young working woman. She is known for having a lot of very modern coats, dresses, and nice pants, stuff that a young woman might want to wear in the workplace but could also perhaps transition and wear in the evening. It's not fast fashion in the sense of Forever 21. These aren't really club clothes. They're not super formal ball gowns, but it's really geared toward this younger working woman.
Okay. Modern, working, young, you can take it home. And Nordstrom's been selling the Ivanka brand for a few years, as I mentioned. How had Ivanka Trump been selling up to now at Nordstrom? Do we know that?
Well, she's a privately held company, so they don't disclose financial figures, and Nordstrom doesn't really break out individual brands like hers. But what we do know, what we can sort of surmise, is that department stores as a whole aren't doing particularly well. Retail is a really tough business to be in right now, mm-hmm. and department stores are suffering sort of more than most. And so when Nordstrom says, "We are dropping her not for political reasons, but because she's not selling well," it's hard to imagine that any department store would drop a brand that was extremely profitable. So I would tend to take them at their word for that, just because department stores like Nordstrom, like Macy's, like JCPenney, they can't really afford to lose profitable merchandise.
And Nordstrom didn't say why they think it's not selling well, right? There was no criticism in there.
No, and no. They really stress that it was only about sales. This is not a political move, mm-hmm. and so department stores drop brands frequently if they don't think that they're selling well. This one obviously has caused a big stir for understandable reasons, and you might also keep in mind that her brand, for some of these stores that are subject to this Grab Your Wallet boycott, which is this big public campaign to boycott companies associated with the Trump family in some way, this has created a headache for companies, including Nordstrom. And so part of the calculation is this brand profitable enough? Is it worth it? Is it worth the headache that we're getting? Because a lot of these companies are hearing from their customers.
Right. This is a group that arranges boycotts of retailers that carry Trump products. It came out of his taped comments about grabbing women, so they called it Grab Your Wallet. And Nordstrom was in the list of top 10 companies to boycott because it carried the Ivanka Trump brand. But we don't really know how boycotting affected Nordstrom in this case.
We don't, but you can imagine, though, that number one, if Nordstrom is hearing from people who are demanding that they drop her products, and number two, if the boycott is having some kind of effect, it's certainly not helping her sales to have a bunch of people signing up to boycott her products, and then to have them drop her, and say that, look, not enough people are buying her line to make this like worth it for us. You have to imagine that the boycott did have some effect on that decision and some effect on the fact that her sales were not great.
Do Trump supporters shop at Nordstrom? Do we know anything like that or could guess?
Yeah, and this isn't, not everyone is happy. It's not just the president that is unhappy about Nordstrom's decision. As soon as the news came out, we saw the hashtag boycott Nordstrom on Twitter. The president obviously has a loyal fan base. She has a loyal fan base. And so this wasn't just announced to resounding applause in any way. And that's something else that these companies have to evaluate, because they know they're sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, people are demanding that they extricate themselves from any Trump relationships. And on the other hand, if these companies do that, they know that they're going to get a backlash from his supporters.
President Trump tweeted that, by the way, we're talking with New York Times business reporter Rachel Abrams about this whole controversy. President Trump tweeted that Nordstrom is treating his daughter so unfairly. So is he saying Nordstrom is lying about its decision, that it's not just business?
I don't want to accuse the president of lying about anything. I'm sure that that's his point of view. But, you know, they, given this incredibly charged atmosphere, I think that there are a lot of people who are accusing Nordstrom of making this decision based not just on sales numbers, but also on trying to take a political stance. And if you believe that Nordstrom is doing this because they're taking a political stance, then you might accuse them of being unfair.
Yeah, well, here's Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer.
This is a direct attack on his policies and her name. So there's clearly an attempt for him to stand up for her because she is being maligned because they have a problem with his policies.
Spicer accusing Nordstrom of directly attacking Trump's policies. Now, we asked our listeners about this. Does this Nordstrom decision change your opinion of this? I mean, this is a Seattle institution, Rachel. Mary wrote in and said, no, it doesn't change my opinion. It won't affect my shopping habits. Nordstrom says they dropped the line for business reasons, and I believe them. But Laura says, now that I know, and this is, Laura represents the majority, I think, of our comments. She says, now that I know Nordstrom has a spine and a conscience, as well as beautiful stores, I'll be willing to spend a bit more and shop there more often. So no matter what Nordstrom says, customers will still make up their own minds about what they think their store is saying. But I suppose you could ask, if Nordstrom were such lefty activists, why would they be selling Ivanka Trump clothes in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, this is a publicly held company. The CEO has, the thing to also remember is that the CEO of this company has a legal responsibility to make money for his shareholders and to make this company profitable. So the heads of publicly held companies don't have a lot of leeway to make very unprofitable decisions that they can't strongly argue would benefit them in some way. Again, I think that kind of speaks to this idea that if this was a brand that was selling enormously well, it would have been a much tougher decision for them.
Speaking of the company's obligation to watch its share price, the stock price dropped yesterday right after the Trump tweet, but then it rebounded and jumped more than 4%. The last time I checked, Nordstrom stock was up about 1% more. You're a New York Times business reporter. How much do you think the stock price today is about the Ivanka affair?
I was really surprised because I think that yesterday it dipped for, I mean, I don't know, maybe half an hour I saw that it was down in the morning, and then it closed up. And I think that it's really interesting because when we have the narrative around the president going after companies thus far has been, it's so dangerous for them because it can really, one tweet can send their stock price tumbling. And I don't know off the top of my head sort of how some of the other companies he's gone after have reacted. But I think one thing is clear, which is that just because the president makes a negative comment about a company, it doesn't necessarily mean that even in the short term, their share price is going to hurt. And I think I wonder if other companies that are right now recalibrating their relationship with the Trump brand, I wonder if they're sort of looking at what happened yesterday and thinking, okay, even if he comes after us, it may not mean what I had thought it was going to mean.
Right. Yeah, that's all a really interesting aspect of this, as we keep getting the president calling out one company after another. And it got more interesting this morning when the president's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, was on Fox News speaking from the White House briefing room, and she criticized retailers for taking political jabs at, she didn't mention Nordstrom right here, but she's talking about Nordstrom, I think it's pretty clear, and other retailers saying they're taking jabs at the president's family.
I do find it ironic that you've got some executives all over the internet bragging about what they've done to her and her line, and yet they're using the most prominent woman in Donald Trump's most prominent, she's his daughter, and they're using her, who's been a champion for women empowerment, women in the workplace, to get to him. So I think people can see through that. Go buy Ivanka's stuff is what I would say. I hate shopping. I'm gonna go get some on myself today.
She go buy Ivanka's stuff. She even called it. She said, yeah, I'm doing a free commercial for the president's daughter's business. Do you know, Rachel, does that violate any law?
There are a lot of legal experts are saying that that certainly seems like it violates federal ethics law, specifically the idea, the law that says that you can, that prohibits public officials from enriching themselves through their office. We know that the president and the vice president are exempt from some of those rules, but it seems pretty clear, according to the law itself and from some of the legal experts that I've spoken with, that there's a consensus that this law does apply to her. So a number of folks, including former ethics officials under Bush and Obama, seem to think that this would not have been an appropriate thing for anybody in the president's inner circle to say, because she is basically promoting, she's promoting the president's daughter, and she's doing it, I think it's, on a White House salary and in an official White House position. I think she might have been at the White House when she was saying what she said. And I think that the law is very clear that kind of constitutes a public office, or I should say that the legal experts I've spoken with say it's pretty clear.
But who decides whether to enforce that rule? Is that up to the Trump administration?
That's a really good question. It seems like, first of all, the punishment for something like this I don't believe this is a criminal statute. I think that if the president wanted to, he could fire her. The enforcement mechanism to me is not entirely clear, in part because this is sort of breaking very, very quickly, and also because just in the broader scheme of conflicts that we have been discussing as with regards to the president and his various business interests, a lot of the things we're talking about have never been dealt with before. We've never had to talk about the emolument clause, a word that has sent many reporters to the dictionary.
Yes.
There are a lot of people, both in the press and in the government, more importantly, that have never had to think about how do you enforce these various laws or issues before.
Just a couple more questions for Rachel Abrams, business reporter for The New York Times. For one, is the Ivanka Trump brand of clothing made in America, which is so important to the president?
No. No. No, there's nothing. I think the only thing, her father had at one point plenty of ties and shirts and so on, and her dad's merchandise has pretty much is pretty much over. Those licensing deals are over. His biggest partner was PVH, the apparel company, which sourced much of his stuff from overseas. PVH dropped him after Macy's dropped him, after he called Mexicans rapists, and Macy's was the exclusive distributor for the PVH Donald Trump brand. And so what's interesting is Macy's right now is the country's largest department store, and Macy's is under a lot of pressure from these boycott groups to dump Ivanka Trump because they carry Ivanka Trump products, and so does their sister company, Bloomingdale's. To answer your question about Ivanka, the biggest portion of her business comes from her clothing line, which is made by a company called G3. And I've spent a lot of time going to Saks Off Fifth and other stores and looking at the labels of dozens and dozens of products, actually hundreds, and they're all made in, overwhelmingly they're made in Indonesia, also Vietnam. But it speaks to this larger point of, there is no apparel manufacturing industry in this country anymore. There is for smaller companies. There are a lot of smaller companies that have been able to do made in America products. But if you're talking about a large scale business, if you're talking about enough sweaters to stock up the shelves at the Gap or enough dresses to supply the Ivanka Trump line, there isn't that kind of trained workforce here anymore. And so the discussion and the pledges around bringing jobs back to the U.S., that's a very difficult proposition to do on the scale that American consumers are used to having, meaning that we as shoppers are used to being able to go to a mall and pay a certain price for a variety of different stores. And we just don't have the infrastructure here to immediately switch and bring manufacturing back to the United States.
Final question then, Rachel. Just let's bring it back to the listener who might want to either go patronize Nordstrom or boycott Nordstrom. Is there any takeaway, is there any message in all of this, do you think, about this new age we're going through of presidential endorsements and conflicts and political shopping?
I think that people will make their own decisions about where they want to shop and who they want to vote for and who they want to support. I think as journalists, the most important thing is that we give people as much information as possible so they can make informed decisions about that. There are a lot of people that might not care that Donald Trump or Ivanka Trump could have a business interest in a company, let's say, that could be subject to government regulation that Donald Trump is now overseeing. But there are a lot of people that does matter to. And our job is not to come out and say that something is right or wrong. Our job is to just make sure that we report what those business connections are accurately and fairly, and what is within and not within the president's purview, and what is appropriate according to ethics standards for him and his advisors to say.
Right. You've heard it, listeners.
According to the law.
According to the law. Yes, yes. You've heard it, listeners and shoppers. Go and make your own decisions with your wallet. We've been talking with New York Times business reporter Rachel Abrams about this latest dust-up between Nordstrom, Seattle-based Nordstrom, and the president's family. Rachel, thank you so much for all this time.
Thank you for having me.
It's KUOW's The Record. Four refugee women from Iraq were set to travel to Seattle just one day before President Trump signed his temporary immigration ban. A snowstorm delayed the flight, and their plans were upended as this executive order went to court. KUOW's Liz Jones spoke with the women as they awaited news from America to see whether they were going to be allowed in.
Would
you like me to call the girls now?
Yeah, I think we're ready.
This is Wasfi Raba speaking through an Arabic interpreter. It's his two sisters who are coming. We're in his living room in Tequila on a plush couch, an ornate tea service on the table.
Hello, that's mine. One
the reporter is here with an interpreter. They will be speaking to you.
On the other end of the phone in Turkey are his two sisters and two nieces. One sister is blind, the other her caretaker. First on the phone is Ibtisam Raba, the caretaker. She's in her late 40s. She describes their life and home there.
Life in Turkey is very difficult and very tiring. It's cold and snow everywhere. The house does not have any heating, so we freeze from the inside the house.
Ibtisam says the four women are always together. And when they go out in public, they disguise themselves as Muslims for their safety. The family is Mandian, a religious minority in Iraq. She says her sister took the news hard when the travel ban came down and their trip was canceled.
She had a meltdown and she started crying and become hysterical.
All their luggage was packed. What would happen now? Wasfi, her older brother, nervously taps his leg as he listens, staring off in the distance. He says they've been on the phone about 10 hours every day since the executive order, an order the U.S. government says is necessary to improve security and the vetting process for refugees. Wasfi was a police officer in Iraq and assisted U.S. forces during the war. He was kidnapped and persecuted and has worked hard to overcome that trauma. His sister, Ibtisam, shares a similar pain.
Back in my country, my husband went missing under mysterious circumstances. And I don't know if it was because of the religious minority that we represent. So I stayed by myself, doing my best to protect my two girls.
She wants to pass the phone to her sister, the one she cares for, who's been blind since birth.
Hello, Sawa.
We thank God for everything.
Salwa talks a bit about their happy childhood together in Iraq and how her siblings spoiled her and were her eyes to the world.
They always took care of me. They took me to the school. I never felt like I was impaired with them around me.
She says Wasfi and his family tell her Seattle is beautiful. Healthcare is excellent, and women have opportunities here for education. In rural Iraq, about half the women are illiterate. Our phone call stretches toward 11 p.m. in Turkey, but one of the daughters asked to speak.
The girls want to talk to you.
It's 18-year-old Brana.
Hello, Brana.
She's only finished middle school and says her biggest goal is to attend college in the U.S. and study math.
I will get a degree in math and be able to solve the biggest equations that no one else can solve.
Brana describes these past years in Turkey as a life without an aim and no purpose, but still, she has hope.
And I do believe that the United States will give me that chance to achieve my ambition.
She tells her aunt and uncle in America that she loves them and they'll see each other soon.
Thank you, Brana.
Almost to comfort them and put her own worries aside. It's a gentle skill that many immigrants seem to learn young. In Tequila, I'm Liz Jones, KUOW News.
And here's an update to that. KUOW has learned that these four women are set to travel to the United States tomorrow. Still, this pending court decision on the executive order that could change things at any time. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. You cannot legally buy a gun if you are a domestic abuser, a felon, or a fugitive. But if you tried to buy a gun, then what would happen? The answer is nothing. Not in Washington State. Nobody follows up. That could soon change, as KUOW's Austin Jenkins reports in our ongoing collaboration with King 5 News in Seattle.
On the evening of January 15th, 2010, Courtney Weaver was in her bathroom, getting ready to go out with friends. Suddenly, her boyfriend appeared behind her, armed with a .45 caliber handgun. He shot her in what she calls a botched murder-suicide.
The .45 bullet went through my right arm, through my upper right lip, shattered 5 teeth, lacerated my tongue, and shattered my entire jaw.
Weaver told her story standing in the hallway outside a legislative committee hearing room in Olympia, where she had just testified.
A third of my face is titanium. I've had 14 reconstructive surgeries since that night.
Since that night, Weaver has moved from California to Seattle, but she lives in fear of the day in 2019 when her attacker is scheduled to get out of prison. She told lawmakers that in the event he ever tries to buy a gun and fails a background check, she would want to have that information.
So I can protect my loved ones and my family and coordinate with local law enforcement.
Weaver wasn't the only one to tell her story in front of the House Judiciary Committee. So did Paula Maher, who we first met in December.
He was extremely scary.
Maher told lawmakers of getting a call from King 5 reporter Chris Ingalls. He told her that her former longtime boyfriend, who she has a permanent protection order against, had shown up on a list of people who had tried to buy a gun in Pierce County but failed a background check.
And thank God, it was kicked back.
But Maher says a blocked sale is not enough.
Who's going to follow up on it? Who's going to look out for my protection and my children? I have hidden for years, changed addresses, go through a P.O. box, because I am so afraid.
Maher and Weaver both testified in support of a bipartisan proposal to crack down on prohibited gun buyers. It would require gun dealers to notify the Washington State Patrol when someone fails a background check for a gun purchase. The patrol would then be required to create a database and investigate these cases, and where appropriate, refer them for prosecution. In addition, victims could sign up for a notification when someone they have a court order against is blocked from making a gun purchase. Police officers would also get notification on their in-car computers. The prime sponsor of the measure is Democrat Drew Hansen, who also testified before the committee.
If you're a criminal and you walk in to a firearm store, you knowingly violate the law by illegally trying to purchase a firearm, you should be arrested, you should be prosecuted. And in an appropriate case, you should spend some time in prison.
Hansen's co-sponsor is a Republican state lawmaker who's also a sheriff's sergeant. Gun rights advocates aren't necessarily opposed, but they are wary. Tom Kwesiak is a lobbyist representing the National Rifle Association. He told lawmakers that sometimes the federal instant background check gets it wrong.
A mistaken identity, basically. So we just want to make sure if somebody's in a database like this, that we're absolutely sure they are the right people.
So far, the proposed law to go after prohibited buyers has earned support from frontline police officers, a county sheriff, and prosecutors. King County prosecutor Dan Satterberg doesn't want to wait for the law to change. He recently told King 5 that he wants police in his county to start forwarding him these cases now.
If they were a felon in possession of a firearm, we'd come down on them like a ton of bricks. And so they're just one step away from being a felon in possession of a firearm. They're worth our time and attention.
King County Sheriff John Urquhart, though, has said he doesn't have the resources to follow up on these cases, nor is he convinced they're worth the effort, especially given the black market for guns. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. You know, Seattle's growing so fast that we are caught up in it. We're caught up in loving the growth and the change, or hating it. What are we going to do about it? My next guest wants you to slow down and really look at your changing city. And he wants you to keep track of what you see in an urban diary. Chuck Wolf is a photographer, a land use attorney in Seattle. He's written the new book, Seeing the Better City: How to Explore, Observe, and Improve Urban Space. Chuck Wolf, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
What is it about the way we're talking about our exploding city that I don't know, it bugs you or it motivates you to talk about seeing the city in a better way?
Well, that's a really good question. The book cover is of Paris for a reason. We're not the first city to be dealing with this over human history. And what I found in my research and in thinking about this in my writing and as an environmental and land use lawyer in the trenches is there's a remarkable common human response to urban change, not just today in Seattle, and we're a very young city, but over human history. And so, to your question, it's easy to say yes or no when we look around and see things that are beyond our control.
What is that common human response to change?
Anxiety.
You feel it?
Yeah. All you need to do is go back and read. This is really high-minded, but read Baudelaire's poetry about the changing Paris of the 1860s. And there's incredible parallels to what's going on in Seattle today.
Would you give us an example of that anxiety that you notice in Seattle?
My street in Madrona. There's a sixplex apartment, little apartment building that was legally permitted some years ago, probably by variance back in the day when this was possible. And there is a single family house next door.
So some of us would see the sixplex as being obnoxious and the single family house as having soul?
However, they look, from another person's perspective, they look the same. There's always a little bit of subtlety to these absolute yes in my backyard or no in my backyard polarities that I'm concerned about here today. As the preface says, right on, we need to find a better way to incorporate our human responses in our public decision making.
Are you saying we have some kind of brain response to a triplex or a sixplex that happens even before we really see it?
Yeah, I think so. And I'll go even farther than that. I believe we have a programmed response. This is not empirical, but just in terms of my experience traveling, I think we have an innate programmed response to dark alleys, to tall buildings, to things that maybe in our DNA back in human history came out of darker intentions. You know, humans are not rational. They're rationalizing. And
well, I agree with you there.
Yeah. And I think that's a real quick way to answer your question.
But haven't you had the experience of seeing these new modern condos, plexes, and they look stamped out? They do.
And I can't deny that. And I've seen it both from a personal perspective and from a professional perspective. And I've listened to people's responses to them. And I would argue that if we could build into our processes, this isn't going to work in all cases, okay? I want to be, my caveat. If we build into our processes of decision-making and input a more visual sense, then maybe there will be fewer that end up that way, both by way of plan development, regulation development, and decision-making. And Seattle is trying very, very hard, and there have been some great things accomplished in the last several years under both Mayor McGinn and Mayor Murray in particular, but I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, so you want us to develop our visual sense and really see, and which brings us to your idea of keep an urban diary. You've got your phone or you've got your camera. So tell us more about what is this diary? What am I supposed to do?
Urban diaries are a range of approaches. And here we're talking the visual because that's my favorite human sense. And that's what I think is the most powerful one. Could be a sketch pad, could be video, it could be auditory, you know, it could be sounds. But the idea is that get out there and understand why you respond the way you do. And one way is to use, I think I used the words, use your camera as a reflexive tool. Click, click, click when you feel something. Mm. And then this is like at the simple level, it's like learning to ride a bicycle, learning to play the piano, all those things that become learning to ski, all those things that become natural later when you do it a billion times. That's in the interest of developing your visual sense in the short term. And how do you present that? Maybe an Instagram account like the Vanishing Seattle Instagram account that we've heard so much about in the last few months. Many examples in other cities of people doing the same thing. But then the urban diary is also something that can ratchet up in complexity. And it can be both a crowdsourcing tool, and I like to say that even the most evocative coffee table photograph can be used for, you know, improvement or reflective purposes, because guess what? When all of the all of the small companies that Google has bought that data mine photos and decide on a aggregate level whether we're happy or not, the input is always a human photo.
So we're having this debate in Seattle about getting more dense and allowing more development. And how would that debate look different if we kept this urban diary, if we developed our visual sense, if we knew what was setting us off and knew what we liked visually and didn't?
Okay. Now, as a Seattle guy who practices law here and has been involved in some of these regulatory improvement efforts, we've got to find a safe middle ground where people aren't going at each other about tower spacing or height or all these push button flare up issues. We got to look behind and maybe find a way to talk about it in a more civil manner. And my sincere hope, if not hypothesis, is in many instances we can do a better job if we create that safe space. And the urban diary is designed to help that along.
So let's use our eyes instead of these good, bad kind of buzzwords and fears and concepts we have.
Absolutely. I like to think about that middle ground, a continuum between no in my backyard and yes in my backyard. There's a vast range of gray in between that we need to accommodate.
Chuck, are you telling me to intellectualize change so that I will accept Seattle losing its soul? But I've got my gut reaction, and I like my gut reaction.
Okay.
I know what I think.
And there's a lot of... Okay, so deconstruct. I've used that word two or three times. Okay, Bill, losing soul. What does that mean? Okay? You just know it, because that's what you're used to. You know, some people very validly feel that way. Okay? I want to be really clear about that. I would like them, however, to be... sure, they mean that. Show me what you mean. Go out and photograph some things that illustrate exactly what you're talking about. Tell me why. Then show me the way you'd like it to be. Help me out. Help me be sure I'm right. Help me be sure you're right. And allow people a little more leeway to illustrate what they mean. And in the end, I don't call that intellectualization. I call that important, and it will help us talk to one another.
Chuck Wolf is a writer, photographer, land use attorney in Seattle. His new book is Seeing the Better City, How to Explore, Observe, and Improve Urban Space. And he's going to be speaking tonight at Town Hall Seattle at 7:30. So that just might be uplifting. Meanwhile, I want to change subjects now and ask you whether you've noticed that our state has some downlifting names, some dismal place names in our state. Have you noticed that? Because a listener of ours did, and she asked our local Wonder Team why. Why do we have a Cape disappointment in our state? And there are several more, right? Social media producer Bon Huberman?
Oh, yes. There's Point No Point, Useless Bay, Mutiny Bay.
Point No Point. That sounds like existential despair to me.
Like there's no point in even thinking of a name right now.
Mutiny Bay sounds kind of cool. I'd like to know what happened at Mutiny Bay.
My personal favorite is Dismal Niche.
Wow. That's truly the bottom of the barrel. Dismal Niche.
What about Big Cedar Stump?
That's kind of literal. It's not so much depressing, but sort of, but not inspired either, though.
That's a kind of sadness to me.
Yeah, like, I'm out of ideas. Big Cedar Stump.
Well, cheer up, Bill, because our local Wonder Team consulted experts and found there is a reason behind those bleak names.
Oh?
And the reason is on our website at kow.org.
Why Foul Weather Bluff? That one I think I can intuit. But Massacre Bay, I'm not sure I want to know. Destruction Island, it goes on and on. So what is the most depressing place name you have encountered in Washington State? Maybe we missed one. Maybe there's something dismaler than Dismal Niche. Or Nismal Ditch, which is also not a happy place. Tweet at us. We're at KUOW. You can also email record@kuow.org. Earlier this hour, we were talking about the Grab Your Wallet campaign regarding Nordstrom. You can search the Grab Your Wallet hashtag on social media and find out about people spending money with companies that align with their values. Well, last year, there was a different hashtag that got journalists in Seattle thinking about the values of their industry. And that hashtag was Journalism So White.
But it's also a movement to draw attention to the fact that a lot of American journalism is often sort of built by and for white culture and maybe excluding some other communities in the country that are part of American life.
That's Monica Guzman, a technology and media columnist here in town and a co-founder of the newsletter The Evergrey. She came in with Seattle globalist and South Seattle writer Reagan Jackson, who has looked at the demographics for Seattle newsrooms.
We're looking very white, which I suppose isn't any huge shock given the demographics of Seattle as well. But for me, I guess what comes up with Journalism So White isn't the numbers as much as it is how the numbers are impacting the quality of the media that we're receiving and impacting the bias of the media that we're receiving.
Will you show us that bias?
Show you that bias.
Yeah. Give us some examples.
Well, sometimes it's about tone. One example is recently the Seattle Times wrote an article about a local artist, Hollis Wong Ware, who's Asian, and in their headline they used the word sidekick. That's not cool to use that term, right? Because to Hollis, to the people affected, this is way more than language. This is a message about how people are viewed. It may seem subtle, but only to some of us, and it seems very direct to others.
Yeah, I remember that, especially because it was a time when we wanted to be celebrating Hollis. Right? Hollis is amazing. She's done so many amazing things in the community. She's just an incredible artist and an incredible talent. And for the Times to just kind of do this tongue-in-cheek marginalization of her, a diminishing of her, it hurt. It really hurt. And I guess I get really tired of also having to be the tone police. I don't want to be the tone police. I feel like the way that the conversation is set up, it feels very antagonistic. Like I'm always like, this isn't right. This isn't right. And here I am trying to like write this counter narrative. And I don't want to do that. I've lost interest in that. Mm-hmm. It's not our responsibility to teach everyone. It's not. If we do it, it's a gift and you're welcome.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like external copy editing, right? Of community relevance and resonance. But that shouldn't be external. That mm-hmm. should be internal. That should come from within the newsroom so that these issues of trust and whether people feel represented just aren't constantly up for debate.
Why do you think that is external? KUOW and probably every media organization will tell you that we want to be more diverse. We want to cover the world. Why is journalism so white?
Well, Yoda would say, do or do not, there is no try. Like, you know, you want to be more diverse. What's stopping KOUW from being more diverse? KUOW. It's not us. Like, we're out here. There are, like, plenty of journalists of color. Like, we were just on a panel with five other journalists of color. But at this point, for me, I'm less interested, too, in being put into white structures and having to go through all the hoops it takes to be included. Maybe I don't want to be included. Maybe I want to just do my own thing. One of the things I really like about writing for The Globalist and writing for the South Seattle Emerald is that those are two publications where I feel like people of color are central. The intention from the beginning was inclusive, and so that's how it's continued. And I feel like with these other institutions that are predominantly white-based, they are continuing as they started. Whether or not we add in a Black person here or a Latino there, like, there's not ultimately a shift in culture that allows for centralization of our voices and our experiences. It's still something other. It's still something counter-narrative. It's still something deemed or seen as non-dominant. Whereas with these other publications and these other outlets, we are the narrative.
Yeah, you asked why journalism is so white, and any organizational culture has a really hard time changing, right? So it's easier to instill that kind of inclusive culture if it's there at the beginning. It's hard to do it after years and years and years and years. So often what can happen is this becomes a question of numbers. My co-founder at The Evergrey, Anika Anand, helped AAJA do the survey you mentioned of
Asian American Journalists.
The Asian American Journalism Association here in Seattle asked many newsrooms for their gender and race breakdown. And we got really interesting information from KUOW, The Seattle Times, The Stranger. And this is a good start because it roots the conversation in something tactile, something, you know, that's real knowledge. But the thing to be careful about, too, is that this when you just add people, you're not necessarily changing the culture. You have to make sure that your organization can embrace what new people bring so that the entire, all the norms of the organizations, all the customs and conventions and the processes sort of change to adapt to the new people coming in and the way they see the city and the perspectives they have on the city. And that's when you can see change really happen. It is very difficult to do that with organizations that have been around a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking about the media. Are there personal stories you want to share that makes this come to life?
So when I first got to Seattle, I worked for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and there are undocumented Latino immigrants who wait outside of places like Home Depot and Lowe's looking for work. And so I speak Spanish, I'm Mexican, and I started talking to them. And I eventually met somebody who I thought had a really compelling story. And I interviewed him, you know, several times, knowing that it wasn't confirmed that the PI would follow up, but thinking that it probably should be. And then the PI sent another reporter from the paper with me to go and kind of finally decide whether this was worth a story. And the decision was that it wasn't. And the man had, you know, family in Mexico he was trying to bring over, and he just had all these stories that to me seemed, what would you need to make this news? What would you need to make this interesting? This is already so different from what Seattle knows. What more do we need? And I didn't fight because I didn't know how, and I didn't have enough confidence. I don't know to this day whether I should have, and maybe if I did, you know, I would have heard very, very objectively definitive reasons why. But I can't help, you know, I think about that sometimes.
Oh, okay. Well, as you're speaking, what kind of came up for me is why I'm a journalist in general. I became a journalist kind of unintentionally. It's like, is in a very backwards way, in that I went to brunch with some friends and I was talking to who turned Alex and Sarah and Jessica, who end up being the founders of the Seattle Globalist, just about international education and my thoughts on diversity there. And from that one conversation, Alex invited me to write a story. And I did. And I did it just because I was interested in it. It was something that I was really passionate about. But I did it without any expectation that it would be published, because I never really considered myself a journalist. And a big part of that is because I always thought journalism was only about facts. It was a form of media in which you couldn't really put in your thoughts or your anything personal. And that had to be very removed. And I think that because that's the journalism I grew up seeing. But through that experience, I learned that actually the stories that I was finding in the community were worth telling, and that it was something that I could do actually as a profession.
You know, that idea of journalism being objective sounds like a very white point of view to me, because like that we can distance ourselves from ourselves, you know, that seems like a very white attitude to have.
Yeah, we've been talking in the industry about objectivity and, you know, does it really exist? Can we really embrace it? For a long time. And I think initially the conversation was about ideological and political objectivity. Mm-hmm. Now we're in this incredible revolution when it comes to how we think about our identities in all these different ways. And journalists as professionals, you know, we pride ourselves on thinking, it doesn't matter who I am. I can tell anybody's story. And I think that's one of the things about journalism so white that is particularly hard to swallow, because there is a criticism. It's a critique about, are you sure? Really? Do you think that just by being, you know, an open human being, you can unlock all the stories you need to? Maybe there's more you need to do, more than you think. And that's a real challenge. That's where a lot of the resistance, I think, comes. And that's where some of the toughest conversations need to go.
Mm-hmm. You need to evolve.
Right.
You need to change. You need to be to gain a different skill set in order to remain relevant. But again, that's actually kind of not the conversation for me. My conversation is more about what can I do as a journalist of color to empower other people in my communities to have a voice and to have a place where their voices are going to be heard. I'd love for more people in my community to have access to KUOW, to be able to be on the radio, to be able to tell their stories in a broader platform. But in the meantime, I'm starting where I am. I'm starting with the Emerald. I'm starting with the Globalist. And we're doing, I think, the most exciting journalism in the city right now. Like, we're killing it. We're setting a bar. We're setting it high. Think of it as a challenge. I want to see white media raise their standards to come up to where we are at.
Okay, so what is the Seattle media world of your dreams? What stories are we getting?
Everything. In the Seattle media world of my dreams, we're getting stories about people in a way that everyone is a person. I know that sounds really basic. It sounds like, what is she even talking about? But I just feel like I would like to see journalism where everyone is treated as a human being, and that everyone's story is explored with an equal depth and an equal sensitivity to who they are and what they're contributing to the world. So I would say stories about activism, art, whatever, all these stories, but just making sure that people of color are fairly represented, are accurately represented and portrayed in a way in which it's evident and obvious that whoever is writing about them understands, knows, and cares about them.
Not reduced, not othered, not put in relation to the white world.
Yeah, all of that. I mean, just, it's not that complicated. I read white media about white people all the time. It does that. I just want to see that all media does that.
Mm-hmm. And it's not checking a box either.
Mm-mm.
It doesn't feel like, you know, now we're going to take a trip to this place that is not really ours, but is in our city. And that's often how it feels.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a place, I mean, I think the ideal Seattle media landscape is one where we turn the volume way up on all the parts of our city that we can barely hear, right? And the idea right now is that, well, we barely hear from them because they're not interesting enough, there's nothing really going on. That's just not true. Mm-hmm. I think we also take a step back from rooting our stories and our journalism in institutions and in official sources.
Mm-hmm.
And we say, this is about people. It's all about people. Why are we even paying attention to anything else? It should always begin with people. And there are plenty of people in these places where we do not hear from. So let's fix that.
That's Monica Guzman. She's a technology and media columnist in town, a co-founder of the newsletter The Evergrey, and she was talking there with Seattle globalist and South Seattle writer Reagan Jackson. We're talking last fall there about the Journalism So White hashtag, and they were a part of a panel at Town Hall Seattle, Monica and Reagan, talking about journalism and whiteness in Seattle, and we're tweeting out a link to the audio of that panel discussion so you can hear the conversation yourself, tweeting that out now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I have a little news update for you. We were talking earlier this hour about the Nordstrom Ivanka controversy. Seattle-based Nordstrom said it'll stop carrying the Ivanka Trump line of clothing because it's not selling well. This morning, presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway went on TV and said, go buy Ivanka's stuff. Well, today, the White House says Conway's been counseled that delivering a plug for the president's family's business violates ethics rules, and a key Republican lawmaker says that's not enough. The House Oversight Chair, Jason Chaffetz, says the White House counselor's comments were, quote, wrong, 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 clearly over the line, unacceptable, and Chaffetz says the matter must be reviewed to the Office of Government Ethics. We'll have an update later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. A little Seattle Symphony for you there, performing last night at Benaroya Hall. Did you hear about this? They gave a free concert called Music Beyond Borders, Voices from the Seven. That is the seven majority Muslim countries under this immigration ban per the president's executive order. This music is from Iran, an Iranian composer and conductor with the Tehran Symphony Orchestra. Let's hear a little bit more now of Fantasia for santur and accordion. Seattle Symphony announced that performance Saturday. 2,400 free tickets went in just a few hours. Another 500 people watched from an overflow hall. More than 140,000 clicked over on Facebook Live to hear the symphony play works from Iran and Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Syria. Music director Ludovic Morlot says many of our musicians are immigrants themselves, so when they suggested we create a concert like this, we enthusiastically embraced the opportunity to bring the universal power of music. And to top it off, last night after playing music from those non-American countries came the evening's final number. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. Thanks, Seattle Symphony, and thank you for joining us.